Clustered Conversations. Clustered Conversations by Weka.
Hello and welcome to another great episode of Clustered Conversations. I'm Josh.
And I'm Bob.
We've got a great episode for you here today, guys. We have Chris Zurich from our Fed team with us today. Chris, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Yeah, so I'm Chris Zurich. I'm a federal SC. Joined WECTA a little bit over a year ago. Been a great run so far. Started out, I feel like, the right way, which is having to install systems, having to solve problems in the trenches, and trying to get systems to perform at their maximum potential.
Which... Did you learn how to search the viewer? That's the question.
Traces?
Yeah.
Search the viewer. Yeah, I've dabbled a little bit with traces, but definitely have more work to do.
Traces is its own interesting thing, and actually realistically quite the program that development put together for that. It's an extremely powerful tool for looking through the logs, essentially.
Yeah, it shows everything that's happened ever, which in federal they like that. That's helpful. And I found that with competing technologies, they're used to looking into equivalent trace options. So
just from like an auditing standpoint of who did a read and from where sort of thing, or?
Yeah, for sure. So they want to know exactly when a file was opened, what part of the infrastructure opened it, how long it was opened, things along those lines. If there was a problem at the same time.
It's useful.
So I remember, I think I met you first working on a crazy, like a performance deal that we're working on with a customer, and we were trying to get to a certain number. And I know they keep upping that number and you guys keep hitting it. So I think we start off like, you know, was it 300 gigabytes a second sustained, and then keeps moving up from there?
Yeah. So we had a system we were going to deliver to a customer, and we had to prove the full potential of the system before we delivered it. So I worked with our engineering team and Rob Roy, our performance guru, to dial in the system and get the max potential out of it. And it really showed me the full potential of multi-container backend, which we recently announced, which is really going to just take our amazing performance right now and double, triple, or quadruple it in an extremely small form factor, which I think is really exciting. That system that I worked on, we hit over 400 gigabytes a second for reads, over 200 gigabytes a second for writes, and I think for IOPS, we hit over 20 million, and we hit around 4.5 or 5 million for writes for IOPS.
20 million. And how big was that thing? How many servers?
16.
16? So 16. And what, were they 1 year?
Not even our maximum strike width, which is crazy.
But they were 1U servers, though?
Yeah, sure. They're 1U servers.
Yeah, so. So it's 16U, less than half a rack.
16U.
Okay. Yeah. 20 million IOPS.
That's
400 gigabytes a second.
We were talking just before this. We have a customer who's got 44 servers. I don't know how many U, probably. It's going to be 2U each, so maybe 88 U. They were doing 1 terabyte a second just in their normal daily workload.
Yeah.
I mean, these are ridiculous.
I remember when like 1 gigabyte a second was a big deal.
Remember when a 2 gig drive was. I remember when a 2 gig drive was a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. The numbers are.
I remember getting my first one gigabyte drive and going, oh, I can fit a whole CD on this thing. Oh my gosh, this is crazy. Like, what am I going to do with all this space? Yeah. Now it's like, yeah, that's less than one episode of anything. Like,
now we spend our time talking about exabytes and petabytes and how to get terabytes a second. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. I was talking to a partner today about that 1 terabyte a second read that you mentioned. And they were more impressed with the fact that it was the amount of data that we actually moved.
Yes.
Because 1 terabyte a second, it wasn't just like a needle up and down. It was sustained performance at 1 terabyte a second. And it moved, what, 700 terabytes of data?
Like, yeah, close to a petabyte, 10. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just an obscene amount, which kind of begs the question, like, what are they moving? what are you possibly moving that you're moving 700 terabytes of data? Like, what are you churning through? But this is the world we live in, right?
So. Well, that rolls us into a question. I mean, Josh and I work in the commercial side, and you're in the Fed. So we often know a lot about the customer's workloads. Some of them keep them somewhat secret, but they give us a pretty good insight into what it is and parameters. I think in your world, you guys are kind of sometimes sizing in the dark, literally.
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, I don't think it's that different. It's just that the workloads aren't exposed, but they have very similar challenges. So, and tell me if I'm wrong in your experience on the commercial side, but once a successful project is executed within an organization, word gets out. And then other projects start getting piled on and other workloads start getting piled on. So one of the things that I always explain to customers is that our ability to handle such a wide range, such a wide breadth of workloads is critical in the federal space. Because their workload requirements are constantly changing. And it's outside of their control, especially due to the structure of how federal contracts work. You have the contracting side that's usually separate from the application side and the developers and the end users. And it creates a scenario where the contractors are literally the ISP. And they have to create these catch-all environments. So you're never dealing with one workload. It's not like, oh, it's always a throughput-based workload. It's like, no, I have small files, I have big files, I have everything between, I have mixed workloads, and they need a simple solution, just like the commercial space, where you want to focus on actually delivering the product to your customer, not managing the infrastructure. So
that is, I'm actually kind of curious then, is the, like big, given the Fed space, gov space is definitely a lot smaller than sort of the overarching enterprise and commercial. Yep. I wonder if news travels faster.
Yes, it does.
You have that sort of more insular, more, you know, hush hush kind of org.
Yeah. Especially in like HPC space. So we've done a ton of work with all of the national labs, pretty much. Anyone who we're not doing work with right now, we're having conversations with them. And the first install I did was at Oak Ridge. And that install spread like wildfire to the other national labs. And they all know each other. It's kind of crazy. It's like all the HPC people know each other. All the people who are running infrastructure at scale know each other. Other organizations are more insular, but still, they're all trying to tackle the same problems.
Everyone's trying to move lots of data. AI has become a big deal all over the place, right? There's surveillance, even in the customers, right? They have cameras that they want to use for capturing video and facial rec, or even just recognition of different objects in the picture. I mean, that's the autonomous driving stuff that we work on for the most part. So it's not much different. I don't think that the workloads are different. It's just the amount you're allowed to know about the workload sometimes becomes different. And then sometimes it's a little easier, I would say, in the commercial, because we can partner with almost anybody. But sometimes when you get in with the Fed, there's very specific contracts, very specific schedules, very specific hardware and software partners you can work with, and you know, in any given project sometimes. At least that's what I remember from my days in the 90s working at a federal contractor.
Yeah, it can be very siloed, but I don't know. Most contracts have an OEM of choice. So the work that we've done over the past year to like open everything up to normalize things and get the OEMs on board to show that we can add value and we can bridge some of the gaps they have. That's huge, because the contract vehicles that exist, they like to cookie cutter everything. So there's an easy button for the government, and it's mutually beneficial. So they just say, you know, I want to buy 10 servers, and they can just execute it. So it's
just, yeah, one more on that whole thread right there. I mean, we, in the last couple of years, right, we started off with HPE when I first got here in Supermicro, right? Then we added Penguin. Mm-hmm. Then I believe Dell kind of walked in there. Hitachi's been involved. Now we got Lenovo, IBM. It's kind of nice. It's the who's who of everyone in the world kind of working with us, trying to get our software on their hardware, which is pretty cool.
Hopefully we'll have some reference architectures coming out with each of them just to demonstrate. Because even in a small footprint, we can blow the doors off things that I never thought was possible. I'm in the middle of delivering a system to one of the national labs, and the single client performance out of Weka is just unreal. So
yeah, you were mentioning
sometimes,
that.
Yeah, it was just, I was talking to a partner today about it, and it helps us differentiate where we're right versus where we're wrong. So like general purpose office shares, home directories, like slow scratch face, horrible.
No.
Waste of time. Yes. Complete waste of time. But like, oh, you invested hundreds of thousands of dollars in GPUs or millions. You want to feed those GPUs, and you want single client performance matters. You want to be able to saturate your 200 gig, 400 gig network. And we can do that. And we delivered a 6-node cluster. And the first thing I did was I spun up one client, gave us 4 cores, and I maxed out the 200 gig network immediately. And they're like, wait a second, what? It's like, yeah, there's 21 gigabytes, like GIB with a big B, of throughput for reads and writes. And they're like, yeah, that's like over 4 times faster than like from a single client. And then on the IOPS side, it's like over 1 million IOPS read and write out of a single client as well. And you start thinking mm-hmm. about how your infrastructure decisions change when you have so much performance that you can gain with yeah. so little overhead as well. It's just like, it's unreal.
Well, we did some testing recently with SageMaker, right? That I saw today. And we were doing some interesting stuff there where we can make the workload by keeping it exactly the same, not changing anything, just running it on Weka and moving the data onto Weka, then running the job. We can cut the job's time by more than 50%. The same job versus what they were doing now. But then the part that got really interesting is if they actually just hosted the data on Weka and not have to move it there, it's 3x faster. So it's like a third of the time.
Because now you get rid of that download step, right? Of pulling off of some S3 bucket somewhere into the local Weka or the local disk. And in the case of sort of standard SageMaker. It's amazing what happens when you don't do data copies. You don't have to do data copies.
I don't think we talk about it enough, Josh. I mean, that's something I think we definitely should spend more mm-hmm. time talking about on the show and everywhere else, is that we help customers remove copies from their workflow. They don't realize that's a time sink because it's always been there, right? It's like, we've always done it this way, so we're going to keep doing it this way. Well, what if you didn't? How much time would you save? Could that job be 5 times faster? It quite possibly could. Or 40 times as one customer saw it.
Yeah, exactly. At the very minimum, just getting rid of that literal waste of time.
Yeah.
Of doing that data copy from a centralized repo, an archive, or whatever, into your live file system to then do work. How about you just do the work? Much better. Well,
that's what it seems like. Data lakes. Everybody says like, oh, I'm going to create a data lake. But traditionally, that's extremely slow. Because there was no other way cost effectively to do it.
It was a bunch of SATA drives and maybe the good old days.
Or more importantly, using an extremely latency intensive like protocol, like you're sitting there doing transfers over S3. And yeah, if you do huge block sizes on S3, you can get fairly reasonable throughput.
Yeah, but not IOPS.
If you have IOPS. Oh gosh, don't need to. But if you have like a bunch of servers all trying to do work at the same time, and they're all pulling down the same data, and they're all pulling that same data down locally, like you're just multiplying that sort of data movement that you've just done, that time it takes to do that, especially if it's a resource constrained data lake that you're pulling from. And now you have, you know, that copy of the data lake, and then potentially dozens or hundreds or thousands of copies across your compute infrastructure, when you could just have one and still make use of an S3 object store on the back end as your cheap and deep storage with Weka. It's massive efficiency gains, massive time savings, wall clock time, job run times.
Yep.
You know, no matter how you look at it, like even if you consider, you know, well, how fast is my local NVMe on a disk? Like I was just looking at some, doing some testing using our NFS stack and looking at, you know, in Amazon, what if I turned on FS cache and use that? You know, maybe I'm, you know, averse to having a bunch of data going across an AZ or something like that. And yeah, it works. Like that caching will function, but is it faster than the network on the instance? It's like, well, if you've got greater than 50 gig on the instance or 50 gig or more, no, unless you're trying to raid together, like software raid together NVMEs on a cloud instance, which I mean, sounds like fun, but maybe dangerous.
Don't worry, they're not persistent.
Well, and it's cache anyway, so it shouldn't be, right? But like it's still slower, and actually it was even less consistent in its speed, which was really curious to see. Like it would drop down to NFS speed when it was grabbing a block that for whatever reason didn't have in cache, and would struggle to accelerate back up to like the 2.5-3 gig that I was seeing. And then it would go up a little bit higher, but then back down to like 2 or 1.5. And it was really variable. Whereas with our POSIX agent, it's rock solid at like line rate.
Josh, I think you had some queries.
I do have something that's sort of itching at the mind here.
I can tell.
how are we well positioned for selling into the federal space? Like what sort of like certifications do we have or do we need? Or are we working on that are going to enable us to sort of be a better fit and an easier sort of shoehorn in?
The first big one, well, there are two. There's FedRAMP, which is on the cloud side, which we're in the process of finalizing. And then there's FIPS, so the encryption side, since pretty much every contract out there is requiring data encryption at rest. So both of those certifications are the cornerstone of what we need to complete. At this point, the nice thing is, though, we can work with customers to qualify each of those in terms of getting a waiver. Obviously, it requires a little bit more effort, but from an accounting perspective, we're prepared to explain exactly how our encryption works and exactly how our software is certified and all those things. There's also ITAR compliance, which we are ITAR compliant, which is essentially, I believe it's the international software
ITAR
compliance piece. Yeah.
I've not heard of that one. International Traffic of Arms Regulation.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think
Weka is a high performance weapon of sorts.
Weird thing, yes. I actually heard about this when I was at NetApp because we ran into a little issue there. So it's public, you know, it was a Senate hearing, and having your company's name in a Senate hearing is always a very interesting thing.
It's always fun. I think it's actually the encryption tech that's being used. You can't export out
if
memory serves, right?
Wow.
And if from all on that as well, memory serves, we the encryption algorithm that we use for our at rest and in flight, that's FIPS compliant, the encryption algorithm itself.
Yeah, it is.
We just have to sort of go through the whole end to end.
Yeah, there's a bunch of checks and balances. They want to make sure that we're using the latest libraries, under the covers, because there's constantly zero-day exploits and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, and if you're in the Fed space, you're probably the target of those O days or those, you know, negative 1 days from various other unfriendly, shall we say, countries that love to poke and prod.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the entire government's a target, unfortunately. Yeah. So, and then data spills and people taking data from these places, that's what every federal agency
is trying to protect against. Or a spreadsheet with social security numbers on the laptop that's on the train.
Yep. Don't share. Is that the OPM one?
Because I still have free credit monitoring because of that.
Security is always here. Yeah, security is great up until, you know, it touches a person. The person's always a security hole.
This is true. If it was all just handled by machines, it'd be much more secure.
Just like computers and software are fantastic if there weren't users. It'd drive me nuts.
I was just rewatching Tron with my sons.
Oh, geez.
And that was hilarious. I never actually watched the first Tron all the way through, and it was a thing, all right.
Yeah.
I feel like that era of movies has like inspired a lot of the tech now.
Yeah.
In terms of Tesla and other companies that are trying to build, you know, all electric vehicles that are modeled after these movies that we grew up with, because all these engineers are looking at it like, oh, wouldn't it be amazing if I built like this all electric, quiet, fast vehicle that had gulling doors?
I still want my jetpack and my flying car, though. Come on, where's those?
Yeah,
right. Seriously, where's
did you see that United
was based in the 20s, wasn't it?
Excuse me. Did you see United's coming out with the all electric shuttles?
Oh wow,
really? They're like quadcopters. Yeah, they're releasing them in Chicago first.
That's awesome. I mean, I've flown, Chicago, there's about, you know, 20 airports around there that they go to that are short hops, like less than a half an hour between Cleveland. Yeah. Then you got Wisconsin, Madison, all these guys, these little short hops that they do all day long, every day.
Yep.
Really?
Yeah. So that would save a hell of a lot of fuel for them as well.
Yeah.
That is pretty cool.
Then on the other end of the spectrum, are you guys tracking the Boom project?
No, I've not heard of it.
Oh, yeah. Commercial supersonic flight.
Supersonic jet that they're building. So I think they're having trouble sourcing engines for it, though.
Well, there's not too many commercially available.
Yeah. Rolls Royce is,
I think,
like,
they're trying to do Super Cruise too, aren't they?
we had the what's it called? What was the plane? Shoot.
The Concorde.
The Concorde, yes. Until we didn't.
Yeah. Wow.
Fuel became far too expensive.
Well, they also had a couple of interesting incidents towards the end. So,
I mean,
accidents happen. Like, it's a machine.
Yeah,
some small break. Problems.
So yeah,
yeah. I mean,
I would love to do it. I mean, I like the concept of low orbit flight, especially since you can get up there and makes the trip actually is slightly faster because you have less resistance on top of everything else.
The Concorde would cruise at 58,000 feet, wouldn't it? Like way up there. Essentially just, what, afterburn up to its apoasis and then kind of sort of powered glide all the way back down.
Well, it depends on how fast you're going. If you go in the right direction, you can't just hang there and let the Earth go underneath you and then just go back and land.
You got to be pretty high up for that one, Bob. if you're going up to geostationary orbit, you're a couple thousand miles out there.
That'd be the fun way to do it.
Might not be any shorter, but could be interesting. Could be very interesting.
This is a long descent.
Very long descent.
Yeah. All right. So, Chris, anything else you want to talk about? Is there some other cool stuff you've seen recently?
Yeah, so we're working with partners along the encryption side. We're qualifying a number of systems with SED drives. Because it removes our need to do any of the encryption, and they're a tried and true offering. And a lot of the latest NVMEs that are coming out are have SED built into them.
Well, we technically support them. It's just making sure the key is there when the system boots, right? That's mm-hmm. a big trick.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the drives need to unlock before Weka starts up, which for that, your boot drive is going to be a SED drive anyway. So,
right.
It's, yeah. So,
hopefully, not an issue. Yeah. Should be all right.
Yeah. Cool. What else?
Cool.
I think I'm excited to see the PCIe Gen 5 systems that are coming out. I know that supply chain's been holding us back in terms of testing them.
Yes.
And I'm also excited to see the EDSF form factor drives that are starting to make their way into mm-hmm. systems, because we're going to start seeing much higher density, which is a common request. They're more power efficient. They're faster. So I feel like we're getting closer to that NVMe to SATA price parity.
Wow.
Especially when you start looking at data efficiency, if you add that on top, depending on workload.
So we're finally going to get those 150 terabyte NVMEs that we were promised like 5 years ago.
There's one company that actually makes those right now.
Do we need 150 terabyte? We got 30s already.
No, we don't.
Of course you do. More the better.
Just need to put more eggs in that one Gen 5 digital basket.
Oh. You just have more baskets. It's fine.
I don't know. I still like the 7 terabyte drives personally.
7.68 are the sweet spot.
Point. Yeah, they get the speed on reads and writes, and they scale pretty fast. 15s are good, but 15s often have very good read, but the writes are always a little slower than everything else. At least unless you buy the really, really high end ones.
Which you should.
Which you should.
That way you get better rights.
Where do you, speaking of rights, where do you guys see, like, is it CXL? The new...
Mm-hmm. We had a podcast on this, actually, with those guys. So,
did you?
Yeah.
We did.
All right. We're actually...
I apologize for not listening.
No, no worries. It's an interesting one that it's kind of like we keep breaking out more and more components from the computer and then putting it onto a network that attaches to it, but it lets us scale independently, right? So now it's going to be interesting to see memory basically separated from the system as well and be able to share as a shared construct. I don't know how that's going to work, but it's an interesting way to do it. I love the idea.
The way I see it, it's an interesting TikTok, not that TikTok, but a to and fro, right? Of and in the beginning, there was mainframe. And then there was open systems, and then mainframe got cool again. But then Linux came out and mainframe went the wayside for open systems.
Then VMware came out.
And now we're going, VMware came out.
Which is essentially a mainframe. But,
which is essentially.
Yeah. Then now, Docker and Kubernetes.
LPARs, baby. Yeah. LPARs.
But now with CXL coming in, I should say, I think that's going to be interesting in what sort of hybrid, like, not quite open system, but I've got these racks I have in a data center, and I really would be cool if like all of these systems just sort of behaved like
one. If you watch, I mean, for the last 40 years, we've gone from single servers to distributed, to single servers to distributed, single servers to distributed. Mm-hmm. Just keep going, doing this dance over and over again.
Yep.
I mean, GPUs are basically back to that single server, right? Even if you have 100 of them, it's still 100 versus 10,000, which, you know, we would do with a single rack. It's more condensed than it was, and we keep doing this dance, but I guess that's just how technology works, right? Just like we had those TCP offload chips for a while there, they were cool, but they were just waiting until CPUs got an extra core and a little faster gigahertz.
Exactly. I'm looking forward to when, because I still think this is true, with PCIe Gen 5, we've made all of these improvements in signaling speed and tech, and the interconnects are now massively, massively fast. Like, we went from Gen 3 to Gen 4, and that took forever. And then Gen 5 just suddenly came out.
I think Gen 4 is getting the short end of the stick there, man. It's just not nice.
Oh, it absolutely is. Yeah, it's definitely not getting its time in the sun.
No.
But processors are still, at least in the x86 space, and maybe in an extent to the ARM space as well, the speed at which a single clock can produce a flop is still relatively unchanged. Like there's iterative improvements. It's still, you know, 10, 12% IPC per generation. But when the generational change from in signaling and transmit on like from PCIe Gen 4 to 5 is 2x, you know, it's 100% faster and not just 10 or 15% faster. You know, it's a 10x generation hop from a CPU perspective ish, maybe 8, whatever. But that's, you know, what a new architecture comes out every year, 18 months or so for CPUs. You know, even if it's just a 6x, that's still, you know, 8-9 years ish worth of improvement on the interconnect. So it'll be interesting to see how CPUs catch back up and what throughput will continue to look at or look like into the future. Because I don't think CPUs right now are going to be able to keep up with PCIe Gen 5.
Yeah, I was at an NVIDIA event this past week, and they openly stated that Moore's Law is slowing down.
They keep saying that it slows down until it doesn't, right?
Yeah, he did for different components away. Though, so CPU clock speed being one. So when was the last time we doubled the clock speed? It seems like we're back into the core count wars where you shove 128 cores into a single socket. Like, okay, that's cool, but then for us, we need to scale. Which, you know, it's where MCB.
Gordon Moore just passed away a couple of days ago, too.
That's true. So, yeah, at 96.
94.
Right.
94. Wow. He'll do it again at 188.
Have you guys, in the Fed space, edge is really important and one of the focuses. Have you dealt with edge at all? We get introduced into big data centers with big data problems, but the big focus, especially in the Fed space, is edge. And how do we do AI at the edge? How do we do data processing at the edge? How do we build an efficient system? And my answer has been converged.
Yeah,
so
that's one
the
way
fact that, we yeah, have a converged offering is a strength, and you can run the applications on the same system. But I'd be curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, we've gotten asks for like video capture systems from people doing a remote video that they wanted to have it as close to them as possible without having to go over the wire, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one. Then there's also, we've talked to oil and gas who want to have it in remote locations, little boxes that are collecting data. We're...
The M&E space as well of having like a central repo for your assets and... Yep. Than your artists in various locations.
That's another one. Then there's also the whole concept of telemetry data capture right at the source. Mm-hmm. So like guys like rocket guys who build rockets, they like to have it on the launch pad and on the landing pad. Mm-hmm. So it gets really interesting to be able to pull that data. Yes, we've been discussing it. We're trying to figure it out, but it's going to be an interesting conversation, right? Trying to figure it out, trying to get it set up. Yeah, but yeah, I know
a lot of nuance there.
We're close as far as being able to build a system, right? Right, Josh? I mean, we can build a system that works with four nodes, right? That's 2U if they do it. The Converge is a much better way to go about it. I like that concept. It's just the customer has to be willing to offer us a couple of cores to be able to run Weka on there, right? And that becomes the balancing act.
Yeah, and then also... Once again, not treating that system like like cattle. It's now a pet again because it's your storage.
Yep.
Don't shut down more than one server at a time.
Right. That's actually a discussion we're having with our research group that's asking, hey, if I had 180 of these things and we run it with Weka on it and converged, can I take down two racks at a time? No, not unless you let me do this crazy thing, which is called the failure domains and are willing to run with a very small stripe. Yes, we can do that. But
then and only then.
Well, it depends. If you put one server in each rack, sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Just need more racks. With that, more though, racks. That's where failure domains, if you put two servers in each rack, or as long as they don't want like 20 servers in each rack, you're okay.
Yeah, we started doing the math, and it ends up being like eight plus two is what the stripe I can do across this entire giant cluster on the way they want to rack them. It's like, all right, we could do it, but you know, this is this is the only way.
So we get amazing performance.
Yeah, they'll have fantastic read performance. Oh, the writes will be a little more hindered, but it won't be that bad, right? It'll still be performant, but won't be at the full scale that we can get to. And the utilization is the one that suffers, right? That's the part that I don't like in something that large.
Yeah. Much better to have a wider stripe if you can.
Exactly. Because, I mean, that's the difference between having a 60% utilization and an 80% utilization in that configuration.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
So cool. I think we've awesome. Gotten to the part where we're just chatting about crazy stuff now. So
spare the listeners' ears here.
Yeah. Is there anything else, Josh, that you want to discuss? Anything else? Any questions for Chris? Chris, anything you can ask us that's not going to be get us shot in the head with a red dot?
No, I'm good.
All right, cool.
Appreciate the opportunity. At the door.
Sweet. Well,
awesome. Thanks, Chris.
I guess for Cluster Conversations, I'm Bob.
And I'm Josh.
Thanks for joining us.
See you next time.